The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our Tuesday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. And I think you're going to find tonight's program different and quite interesting. I'll get to that in just a minute. For those of you who would like to call in and talk with our guest, who I will introduce in a minute, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we're not working with call screeners. Be patient. Let it ring, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. I do hold callers over the break, and I'll also answer the phone if it rings over the break. If you would rather email us, or you have no choice but emailing us, the email address for tonight is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Do remember we're trademarked, copyrighted, but we do allow all of you to download the programs and freely distribute them and share them to people that you think should be interested in it, must be interested in it, have an interest in it, or would benefit from it. There's a couple of restrictions, not very many. Please don't do anything commercial. We don't do written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. And please no edits of the program for a YouTube video or even for edits on your own website. And we appreciate your following those simple guidelines. Remember, a 90-minute show is roughly 40 megabytes. If you don't know how to send a file that large over the internet, please feel free to contact me. But there's quite a few programs out there that will do it for free quite easily. So not a hard thing to do if you want to send it to somebody who you think should know about the Space Show. Our website is thespaceshow.com. So when you go there, you'll find our newsletter, the detailed newsletter. It's in the middle of the page. You can't miss it. And that has all of the details of our programs, our guest bio, and it's the only place you'll find a future events section for the Space Show. And then since we do sometimes have to change our schedule, guests have interruptions in their schedule, and we have interruptions in our schedule, certainly lately, given the fact that we're moving, check it and stay current, because when we do have an interruption in the schedule, this is where we post it first. And then later on, we send it out by email. But do check the newsletter on the website to stay current, and I think that'll serve your interest really well. And as I said, it's the only place where there is a future events section telling you who's up in the next couple of weeks on the Space Show. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website quite easily, or you can easily download the programs. This goes back to 2001, so that shouldn't be a problem for you. And if you need help in doing that, please don't hesitate to get a hold of me. There's a store up near the top of our website. It's called Space Show Gear. And probably the most important button is the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we are a nonprofit 501c3 educational program, and our nonprofit is onegiantleapfoundation.org, and we exist solely because many of you do support us and help us. That's how we deliver free content to you, do the kinds of programs that we do, and even have the webinars that we bring to you 4 to 6 times a year. Remember, if you are paying U.S. federal taxes, you do get a tax donation for the nonprofit gift, and the same is true if you're paying California taxes, as we're a California public benefit corporation. And let's see, we do podcast, and gigadial.net with Andrew Grummet is our podcasting client. You will find our RSS subscription URL on our website, both our short-form newsletter and our long-form newsletter. excuse me, and we're in iTunes and Zoom, astrospacenow.com, yastro.com, Podcast Alley, and a host of other places on the net. And the favorite app I use on my iPhone for the podcast as well as archive programs comes from live365.com, which is one of our streaming services. And it is free, and it works really well, at least it does on my iPhone. If any of you are using it and you need help configuring it to find the Space Show, please send me an email, and I'll send you the one or two lines instructions I have. And then I guess that's what I want to tell you for announcements. And if you have any questions about any of this, please do get a hold of me. And the best way to do that is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Also, do remember we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. In fact, Brian Whedon of the Secure World Foundation is our guest tomorrow morning about the space fence, and more about that later, but not tonight. But that program is tomorrow, Wednesday morning, 9:30 a.m. California time. And remember, the Secure World Foundation has a really great website, and they have all sorts of white papers and documents there, plus summaries of their programs that they have in Washington, D.C. and around the world. They promote cooperative solutions for space security and furthering space development in many, many different ways. You can get a lot more information by visiting their website, which is www.swfound.org. And remember, they sponsor our webinar series, and they're absolutely terrific organization to work with. And that brings me to tonight's program. And I'm really happy to introduce to you, and hopefully I get his last name correctly. I still carry that Oklahoma twinge with me on last name, Dr. Jason Reimuller, and he is with Project POSSUM, which is a polar suborbital research project devoted to ongoing observation of our home planet and changes. Their website, which you should call up and follow, is Project POSSUM, POSSUM.org. Jason is a research scientist with the Space Science Institute and president of Integrated Spaceflight Services. He serves as the PI for Project POSSUM, which is Polar Suborbital Science in the Upper Mesosphere. And this is a campaign to study the polar mesosphere and, I hope I get this word right, noctilucent cloud structures using manned, reusable launch vehicles. He's a leading development of spacecraft egress and training modules, training simulators, and analog space training capability. He also works as a commercial research pilot, flight test engineer with GATS Incorporated. He's now a scuba dive master and author of Spacecraft Egress and Rescue Operations. He served for 6 years as a systems engineer and project manager for NASA's Constellation program, leading studies on launch aborts, launch commit criteria, landing conditions, post-landing emergency crew egress trades, and propulsion operations. He also led a NASA and NSF-funded flight research campaign to study noctilucent cloud time evolution structure and dynamics in northern Canada as lead investigator and pilot in command, and then further applied his background in airborne remote sensing to conduct research glaciology to better understand the dynamic changes of the Greenlandic ice sheet as part of NASA's Operation IceBridge. He's a commissioned officer in the Air Force, a spacecraft flight director for Space Systems Loral. He has his Ph.D. in Aerospace Engineering Sciences from the University of Colorado in Boulder, which has a lousy football team. He also holds an M.S. degree in Physics from SF State University, an M.S. degree in Aviation Systems from the University of Tennessee, an M.S. degree in Aerospace Engineering from the University of Colorado, a B.S. degree in Aerospace Engineering from Florida Institute of Technology. And, Jason, I think you're going to rival Mike Griffin for college degrees. How about that?
No, I believe he had 7 at last count, and I think I'll give him the undisputed title.
And his are, I think, all PhDs, but you're approaching there. It's nice to talk to you, and listeners, one of our favorite Space Show guests, Sean Casey, introduced me to Jason, and I don't know if Sean is able to listen tonight, but I want to thank him very much for the introduction. Project POSSUM, tell us about this, and God, there's so many questions I want to ask you about your background, even including Constellation. Maybe we'll get into that, kind of get the straight scoop on what you really thought of Constellation at the time. But Project Possum, tell us about it.
Well, great. First, Dave, I'd really like to thank you for having me on the show, and also thank Sean Casey if he's listening, and he's been an enormous ally, asset to a lot of the project, and the Silicon Valley Space Center that he's heading up is a fantastic organization, and really, it's exciting to be a part of that shared vision with them. But Possum, aside from being an Australian marsupial, we couldn't find anything that really fit with an O to go with the North American version of the opossum. So we went with the Australian version. Besides, everyone loves the marsupial. But Project Possum, like you had mentioned, is really seeing the opportunity to use these reusable suborbital vehicles to study a part of our ecology, our atmosphere, that has been historically very difficult to access. The mesosphere, we know so little about that. It's been way too high to get to by aircraft or balloons, and yet too low to really get to by satellites. So our knowledge of that has been really obtained by sounding rockets, but there's certainly limitations, and it's not the most cost-effective way to get information. But the upper atmosphere really is the most sensitive part of our entire ecology. So getting to understand that better, it's a good way to understand the small changes, how small changes in our lower atmosphere can reflect themselves in large changes in observables. And noctilucent clouds, surprisingly, knowing how thin the air up there, actually makes an extremely good observable of the upper atmosphere. So Project Possum, the vision of it really is broader, but it was kicked off, was conceived about 2.5 years ago at a conference every 2 years called the LPMR. It's a really geeky acronym called Layered Phenomena in the Mesopause Region, but it's a small group of scientists that study this region of the atmosphere, and Dave Fritz and Gary Thomas and I came up with the idea of proposing an experiment to NASA's Flight Opportunities Program using a reusable suborbital launch vehicle to get in situ imagery of these clouds that we can develop a tomography from, and from that be able to model the areas better and to try to understand ultimately how energy and momentum are deposited. Dave Fritz has been described as a national asset, and I have to agree, he's really top at developing computer models of atmospheric structures, especially noctilucent clouds. And Gary Thomas is so well respected in this field, he even has a unit named after him. It's conventional in the astronomers that deal with noctilucent clouds to refer to units of cloud albedo in terms of Gary's. So couldn't have asked for two better people to go in on this proposal with. My background was more in the engineering and operations. My dissertation at the University of Colorado got a small aircraft. It's a Mooney 231 that I took out the back seat and put in a bunch of cameras and went up to the Northwest Territories in Canada and flew the plane in a way to intercept a satellite that was looking at these clouds from space. And by getting up to a certain altitude, we could get some synchronized imagery that was able to help us understand the low level and the most sensitive thresholds of these clouds. With me is my instrument instructor, Bruce Hulley, who's been a fantastic aviation mentor through the years as well. So we had a good nucleus of the team. We proposed to NASA Flight Opportunities. They said it was a great idea and supported us, and we got the acceptance. And I believe it was March 2012, guaranteeing flights to support the instruments for this experiment. So that was the genesis of this. I could continue with some of the science.
Well, let me ask you the first dumb question, and I'm sure there's someone out there other than me, but what actually is a good definition of a noctilucent cloud? Because I'm not familiar with them.
Great. Okay. Noctilucent clouds form in the mesopause region of the atmosphere. So the atmosphere is, there are five levels of the atmosphere. the troposphere, where most of our weather occurs, is the lowest,
right,
defined by colder temperatures as you go up in altitude, and in the stratosphere above that, where you absorb most of the UV radiation of the sun, and so there's a positive temperature lapse rate as you go higher. And then once you get above to the mesosphere, the temperature drops again. And when you get up to about the mesopause, about 100 kilometers in altitude, that's the coldest part of our atmosphere. And above that, when you hit the ionosphere, you get the absorption of the highest energy particles. So the atmosphere, even though it's very thin, warms up greatly from there. So you have this local temperature minimum up there, and that's what seeds these types of clouds. Now, the air up there is incredibly thin, like a millionth or so of the density at the surface. So it's amazing you can visualize anything there. But what we have observed have been these very high altitude, often referred to as space clouds, and they appear to glow at night. The reason being is that they're so high up that they still reflect light long after the sun has set. Now, we've observed these clouds. The first known observations were in 1885, and that was generally accepted that that was triggered by the forcing from the Krakatoa explosion. Now, since then, and especially in the last 40 or 50 years, we've been noticing more and more of these clouds, not just in intensity, but duration of the season. They've been coming to lower latitudes. They've been coming more with more intensity. So one of the big interests of Noctilucent clouds are the possible links to global climate change, in particular the man-made drivers of climate change. So we observe the clouds behave this way. We ask why. We know we need, essentially two things for clouds to form. We need low temperatures relative to the dew point, and we need water vapor. And, the hypothesis is that the two main man-made drivers of climate change, methane, photodisassociates in the upper atmosphere. One of the main byproducts is water vapor. Well, carbon dioxide, even though it acts as a greenhouse, like a heat-trapping gas in the lower atmosphere, in the upper atmosphere, it acts as a net radiator. So increasing levels of CO2 tend to cool the upper atmosphere. So we think that by introducing more of these elements into the atmosphere, and as they are linked, convected to the upper atmosphere, probably by gravity wave action, that this is being deposited and changing the chemistry of the upper atmosphere and causing us to observe more of these clouds. So it's still an area that, the verdict is still out on this, but we hope that this experiment will really help us understand more of that link between the lower atmosphere and the upper atmosphere, and so that we could look at this and more definitively saying that, we're observing these changes because of changes that are happening in the lower atmosphere.
Now, in your bio, it said that you're talking about manned flights for this. So does that mean like you're going to use an X-Corps vehicle or a Virgin vehicle or something like that?
We have been looking mostly with the X-Corps links. And certainly there's several platforms that are being developed or designed that can access this. The Lynx has the experiment is, let me back up a little bit and describe where these form and the constraints around these. We see these within a period of about a month around the summer solstice. So a little counterintuitively, the only time the upper atmosphere gets cold enough for these clouds, it's in the middle of the summer. So the temperature there is at its minimum, and we see these clouds from a little bit before summer solstice to maybe 40 days after the summer solstice. You also have to be at a high latitude. So you need, you have a mission where you have to be somewhere at a high latitude at a specific time. Furthermore, there's no way you can really predict when you will see these clouds. And deployments aren't cheap. So based upon my own experience chasing these with aircraft, that I gave NASA a high probability that if we went up on the third week of July at a high latitude, and we proposed two places, both have their benefits and both have their potential problems, one being near Fairbanks, Alaska, at Eielson Air Force Base, and the second one being potentially in Sweden, that in northern Sweden, that there would be a very high probability that we would have at least one, if not two, observations of these clouds.
And so the Lynx would launch from either the Air Force Base or that spaceport in northern Sweden?
Yeah, so the real benefit of the Lynx is that it's just a two-person craft. You have a pilot and you have a scientist, and you can each flight is on the order of about $100,000. So you can dedicate the whole vehicle much more easily to a place at a time where a vehicle like Virgin Galactic certainly can access that very well. To dedicate each flight there is on the order of about $1.5 billion.
Yeah, it's a much bigger capability. I forgot what I was going to ask you, but so let's see. So you would launch in a Lynx from it. Do you see the clouds first? I mean, do you know that they're there and then you launch, or are these like search and find missions and you hope they're there and you launch anyway?
Well, we wouldn't launch unless we have confirmed their presence. And most likely we'll be able to confirm that just visually from the ground. We also, both those facilities have a local LIDAR facility. That's a big laser that will shoot photons in the atmosphere and can actually bounce off the cloud layer, and you detect the backscatter in a big telescope. So there are two different ways that we would be able to confirm the presence of a cloud. And if you confirm the presence of the cloud, you can launch very shortly after. And another great thing about the Lynx is that it's designed to be able to repeat a flight every 2 hours. So you could feasibly, if you see a cloud, and they're typically present for in the order of 4, 8, 12 hours, you could launch every 2 hours while it's up there. You could have four suborbital flights in situ observations of these clouds in a single observation of the cloud.
Here's your first email question, and this is Jeremy, and Jeremy always emails in from Tucson. And he says there's an organization called Astronauts for Hire that want to fly science missions like you're talking about for the investigators. Would your scientists be the people flying and working this, or would you farm this out to something like Astronauts for Hire?
it's an interesting question. I served as the operating officer of Astronauts for Hire initially. This is certainly the many of the members in A4H, as it's called, are very eager into using these next generation vehicles to promote their own scientists, much like Project Possum is doing. So it's certainly a very, very good organization that has been involved with commercial and suborbital space since its inception in early 2010.
So it's a possibility, but the scientists probably want to do it themselves, right?
Well, not entirely. There are certainly many organizations that some scientists would go through training that organization A4H provides, for one. Other organizations may not. The premise there is that it might cost a lot more to train someone than it would be to use someone that has gone through the training and that can work as a peer that specializes in the region of of science, and that can work equally as a peer, but be able to represent the operations issues that go around doing a flight.
So, are you dependent on X-Corps becoming operational? For example, if they were flying the Lynx today, would you be able to start your scientific experiments and missions today? Are you ready for that, and you're just waiting for the vehicle to become operational?
Well, this particular experiment is going to need to rely on the Lynx Mark II, and so that will be about a year behind the Lynx I. It's not singularly dependent on X-Corps. We've looked at several options. Certainly Virgin Galactic can do that, and they're very mature in their designs as well. X-Corps has been the company that we have baselined in the designs, but we have maintained in contact with a number of the more credible flight providers.
So when any of these companies are operational, are you ready to go, or do you still need preparatory work even after they become operational?
Well, most of our payloads are ready. We have tested them in aircraft. Most have heritage. The payload suite that we have designed has been designed mostly to integrate with the Lynx vehicle. What we've essentially done is we've turned this into an aeronomy laboratory using imagery and remote sensing. So it's not just getting the imagery of the clouds. We're using every available cubic inch of the vehicle that we have accessible to payloads to really address some of the under-answered questions about noctilucent clouds. For example, the imager suite itself is still and video visible cameras as well as still and video infrared cameras that have the infrared cameras coming from Utah State University. Mike Taylor is the PI of that. And the infrared cameras couple the imagery with airglow layers. And the idea for the first time is to try to get stabilized imagery of the airglow structures that usually above noctilucent cloud layers and see how they couple vertically with observed structures in the noctilucent clouds. The other thing we are doing, we have one payload that we're very excited about. One of the big questions is, what are the shapes of NLC particles, NLC noctilucent cloud particles? We have assumed, probably incorrectly, that they're spherical, but probably they are not entirely spherical. A group from the University of Colorado and Sigma Space Systems, led by Jeff Thayer and Steve Mitchell, have developed a depolarization LIDAR system. And it's a LIDAR system that alternates the polarization of the laser beams that it shoots out. And the backscatter, comparing the differences, are actually going to allow us to get a good understanding of the shapes of these particles. So what does that tell us? The shapes will let us know about how these particles themselves grow and evolve and ultimately sublimate as they in the process from where they nucleate the mesosphere at the mesopause and start to fall as they grow and as they grow they descend, and as they descend they get to warmer parts of the air, and then at about 83 kilometers, which is the altitude that we observe these clouds, they sublimate and that's where we physically observe the cloud. So that's a payload we're really excited about. The other two payloads that we've baselined for the mission, one is an instrument called MASS, and that's from the Laboratory of Atmospheric and Space Physics. Zoltan Sternovsky is the instrument PI of that. MASS is an aerosol detector for neutral and charged particles, and this has had a long history of sounding rocket experiments, but we are reconfiguring this for use in the Lynx. There are two what we call coffee cans, or basically about the size of coffee cans, but they can support external payloads in the back of the Lynx. So these are can be exposed to the RAM, to the external environment. And then the other coffee can, we have an experiment that will be able to tell us the density, and from that we can infer temperatures in situ from this. And it uses it in two different ways. One is a pressure gauge, and then there's also a very sensitive accelerometer. So we're able to get density profile as a function of our altitude, and in a way. And what makes us all unique is that these are all working together. So as we build a tomography from our imagers, much like a CAT scan device builds tomography around a person's body, we would be doing the same with these cloud layers. But we're also imaging these with infrared airglow layers coupled. We will ultimately be looking at the particle shapes and size distributions as well, and providing the actual sensed densities, calculated temperatures, and aerosol distributions to go along with the modeling efforts. And that's something that's never really been put together in this way before. The Lynx has that flexibility, and we'll be able to control the attitude and the pointing as we go. It's actually an interesting trajectory. Obviously, we're pointed straight up at the main engine cutoff, but then we're free to point the vehicle in most any way. So after the main engine cutoff, we can orient to the north, and we'll be essentially going right up like an elevator, with pointed north to the presumed higher density of the clouds. And as we actually go through the cloud layer, we'll be able to pitch in a way to actually scan a good range, and that will really help us get the tomography in the local area, get the imagery that we'll build the tomography from.
Did you get your interest in this in school, or how did you get your interest in this type of work?
I have always been involved with this. I grew up mostly with my grandfather. He was an Air Force general. So I grew up with planes and stories of B-25 missions over Italy and
the Mitchell.
And from that, I remember in when I was in first and second grade, always being the one reading through the Apollo books in school, and it was always always an interest to participate somehow in the space program. And I think later, what really got me focused into this, it was probably a combination of an interest in studying climate, really understanding our climate as one of the most pressing issues of our time, not the most, and realizing that the background that I was building in aerospace engineering was one of the best tools to have to understand this part. But on the other side, I still always maintained an interest in the space environment. I had some weird calling to polar regions as well, too. I always seemed to really feel at home when I was up on some remote island in the far north. And this had all come together. It was ironic how I met my advisor, Jeff Thayer, at the University of Colorado. I took a little vacation in Bolivia and managed to get trapped in the revolution when they overthrew Goni in 2003. So I was physically trapped, and I at that time I happened to come across Jeff's research, and before he'd moved to the University of Colorado. And so I called him, and I think I just always stuck in his memory from, who's this weird guy that just called in the middle of this Latin American revolution when you could, hear dynamite from the protesters going off. But we just started a dialogue and conversation from this, and then ended up going to be his graduate student, and then I got involved with Noctilucent Clouds. I didn't know much anything about those until that time, but got involved with the LASP then and with the AIM project, and AIM really was the specific experiment that was the first NASA satellite that was had a primary mission to study these clouds, and I came in with a background in flight test engineering, and so I was always thinking of, well, we understand these a lot in terms of what we get from spacecraft, and we have lots of ground imagery, but what can we access from airplanes? And that became my dissertation, was bringing in that flight operations experiment, finding that there are a lot of things that we can only understand from aircraft. Time evolution is one, and the synchronized observations were another. And so in a sense, this project was very similar to the same line of thought as that dissertation. Now we have this new capability. Everything provides a little piece of the puzzle that we had, and how the airplane was able to provide one little piece of the puzzle that we were able to augment this now with these suborbital vehicles and having a stabilized platform in a way that there's a lot of advantages that we find. Instead of the sounding rockets, here we have a means to get stabilized imagery and do numerous sequential observations. We can track specific microfeatures. Having an operator enables that. And we're doing this at order of magnitude less cost. Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so it's really just recognizing another opportunity to fit in a piece of the puzzle and to try to tie this together into an integrated picture.
You have an email question from George, who is in Chicago. He says, I have a two-part question for you. Number one, how is Project Possum funded? And number two, you keep talking about airplanes, so I'm assuming you're talking about general aviation planes, so they don't go to that high of an altitude. What altitude works for your research? Can you do this easily with general aviation airplanes, or are you talking about general aviation executive jets that can go higher?
Okay, that's a good question. The first question, how are we funded? We funded initially through NASA's Flight Opportunities Program. We are still seeking funds to support the larger aspects of the deployment. So that's something that we are actively engaging the Science Mission Directorate at NASA as well to get the funds that will be needed to actually get the science out of it to develop the tomography at a time. And we're also engaging foundations for support. We also have a small film team that is developing a documentary with this, and we hope that's going to be another means not just to communicate the science and to educate the public, but another means to bring in support for the science.
Are you doing what everybody else is doing and doing a Kickstarter campaign?
Well, that's that's something that is on the books, but for a different reason. The Kickstarter campaigns largely pre-sell your products, let people get involved. I could revisit those in a bit. Let me address that second question about the aircraft first.
Okay.
So these clouds are just about it. Let's see. The turbo Mooney I was using has a ceiling altitude of 25,000 feet. The clouds form at about 375,000 feet.
Wow.
So wasn't quite getting up there.
Well, wait a minute. Hold on a minute. That means they're forming in space, because space is about 360,000 feet, right?
Well, that depends on what we call a space. Yeah, the standard definition is, the one that a lot of people use is 100 kilometers.
Right.
These clouds form at 83 kilometers. The Mooney we're flying, that is roughly about 7.5 kilometers. And the AIM satellite that was looking at these from space was orbiting in a sun-synchronous orbit of about 600 kilometers. So the clouds were kind of in the middle between the plane and the
So are the clouds ever actually in space, or I guess space depends on where you're at and some other conditions, right?
Well, some people call space at 60 kilometers, and so by that definition, they are. And if you call it 100 kilometers, then they're not. So it's oh, I guess in the definition of the atmosphere, technically the shuttle is orbits in the ionosphere. So it's a nebulous definition.
And getting to 25,000 feet gives you a significant advantage over being Earth viewing.
Getting to 25,000?
Yeah, in your Turbo Mooney, 25,000 feet is a significant viewing advantage over being on Earth.
It is. You get over most of the absorbing and scattering species. You're also able to be at a specific position at times, so we're able to intercept the ground track of the satellite to look at common features. And we were also flying in a way that compensated for the sun's motion. So around local midnight, as the sun dip deeper below the horizon in the northwest, we were flying a northward component. And then we were going directly west, right at local midnight. And then we started introducing a southern component once the sun started rising. So in that way, we forced the sun to be at a constant 8.5 degrees below the horizon. And that helped us, get a observation of the cloud where the scattering angles we did our best to force it to be constant.
And are you the one who flies the Mooney?
Yes, I'm a Mooney pilot.
So, and you're the only pilot of the aircraft, right? So everyone else is a researcher on board? Because you can take one or two more people, right?
There was two of us. We had a co-pilot that was monitoring the instruments, and the back seat we removed and put in an optical bench with the cameras that were looking out of the right side of the plane.
Sounds like an absolute ball of a job that you have.
Well, it was an interesting one. It was going up to the Northwest Territories. It was quite remote, and actually the sortie that we got our best imagery, the one that we got a paper out and ultimately grounded my PhD. Well, we came back, and despite our best weather resources, reading and flight planning, there was just not that much data up there. And we came back, we had a comfortable reserve of fuel, but there just happened to be a very active thunderstorm over our town. We realized we didn't have enough fuel to wait it out, and I remember my granddad's once saying that you never intentionally fly through a thunderstorm outside of wartime. Well, it was, I guess, the first time I had to intentionally penetrate a storm, but it was, fortunately, it wasn't a big one. But it was an interesting story to go with the images that ended up grounding the research paper of the campaign.
I learned to fly, but of course, single engine and NVFR, and they always talked about the 180 as the safest route home rather than going into a storm or clouds. But I didn't have the training that you had, but and a Cessna doesn't go anywhere near 25,000. A Cessna 150 or 180 doesn't go anywhere near that kind of altitude.
So 180 up there puts you a long way from anywhere else to land, especially at dusk or night.
Well, but the good thing about it is they can land almost anywhere. So I don't know what the terrain is like, but those things can easily land in a field or someplace. So, that's the good side of it. The bad side of it is if you don't have something like that around, you're going to probably be SOL quickly. We're at our break point. This is a really fascinating discussion. In all the years I've been doing the space, I've never heard of any science or anything like what you're talking about. I mean, I'm really amazed that this has gotten by for 2,100 plus space show programs in more than 12 years without ever anything coming close to discussing this. So. Hang on. We're going to take our 3-minute break because we're halfway through the program. And listeners, when we come back, hopefully you'll pick up the phone and call. Not too many of you are at work tonight. 1-866-687-7223. Back in 3 minutes with Jason.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Tuesday Space Show program. We're talking about Project Possum with the PI of the project, Dr. Jason Reimuller. And Jason, Tim in San Diego sent in a note, and he says, is there research on these clouds and in similar areas going on in other countries around the world, or are you the only ones doing it? I've not heard of this research before.
That's a good question, Tim. Indeed, there's a good international collaboration to study these clouds. And most of the countries, sensibly, are those that are at higher latitudes. The LPMR, the Layered Phenomena and Mesopause Region Conference, is a very, very multinational, has very multinational attendance there. Some of the biggest players are in Germany, and MISU, the Meteorological Institute at Stockholm University. Jörg Gumbel is heading that up. There is DLR in Germany. They've been very active. John Plain in, at the University of Leeds was the host of the this year's LPMR, and he's been very active with the research of these clouds. There's been ground observations. Russia has had ongoing observation programs through, for many decades. U.S. and Canada certainly. There's interest in Antarctica as well. It's we see these clouds in the Antarctic summer as well in January. So many of the research stations at the south in Antarctica support some Noctilucent cloud experiments. Different spacecraft, now AIM, the Astronomy of Ice in the Mesosphere satellite, is the only one that has been dedicated with a primary mission to understand these clouds. But there are many other satellites, too, that have observed and gotten data from these clouds as a secondary mission. And they go back 20 or 30 years of satellite data. So, there's a growing interest, certainly, and there's a growing interest for several reasons. I mentioned the possible links to the man-made drivers of climate change, but they're also of interest because it's a reentry region. And so historically, for example, the space shuttle has not been allowed to reenter through an observed cloud. Now, the space station, for example, is a fairly high inclined orbit, so it's feasible there could be Noctilucent clouds at the latitude that the International Space Station orbits. Would it hurt the space shuttle to go through a cloud? Probably not, but we don't know. There's so much we don't understand, and NASA's simply set up a reentry constraint around that.
Well, of course, we'll never know now since the shuttles are gone.
Right, but any manned reentry vehicle, we didn't know enough about the physics of those, and you hit anything going Mach 25, it was just something that they had historically set up a constraint against.
So even
those that aren't.
So no manned entry vehicles have gone through these clouds.
I don't know if Russia's ever intentionally reentered one.
How do you avoid it if it's on your path coming back?
Oh, you can control the latitude, the reentry corridor. You can reenter through an ascending or a descending node, and you can also observe these from the ground. So there's also just about a 1 month window per year that we can even see these clouds. So realistically, it's not that big of a constraint. I don't even know if it's ever altered a mission plan in the history of the space station or the history of the space shuttle.
Interesting. That's something I'm gonna find out when next time I talk to one of the flight operators who works shuttle.
Great. Please let me know.
I will let you know. I'll let you know what they tell me if they ever had a constraint on that or had to deal with that. They'll probably
There's
go, what?
A really good benefit to people engaged in comparative planetology. You look at low-density atmospheres on other worlds, and it's a good way to model those atmospheres.
Actually,
for example, Mars.
You have a question about that. This is from I don't know why they're using email tonight. Come on, listeners, you can't all be at work. It's 1-866-687-7223. Sandra is in Spokane, and she says, do these clouds exist on other planets like Mars, maybe Venus, or anything that we can tell, or are they unique to Earth?
I am not sure about that, Senator. That's a fair question. I guess you would see stratified layers wherever you would have sufficient water vapor and sufficient temperature dew point to permit them to form. I confess I'm not that knowledgeable about the atmospheric structures on other planets.
So when you plan on going up in the Lynx, you're going to fly through these? Well, no, you wouldn't be able to fly through these clouds because the Lynx wouldn't go up high enough, would it?
The Lynx Mark II, the Lynx Mark I will have an apogee of 61 kilometers. Now, there's benefit to that, but to actually get the tomography, we'll need the second variation of the Lynx, and that'll go to 100 kilometers, and we'll be able to go through that. So when we go to the Lynx Mark II, the operator will be able to sweep the clouds and get a range of imagery from that. That won't be possible from the altitude that the Lynx Mark I will be able to get to. And also the Virgin Galactic spacecraft has a similar apogee of about 110 kilometers, so that would be a suitable platform as well.
Here's a fun question from you. This is Paul in upstate New York. Who made your logo?
Well, it was a joint effort. I have to give most of the credit to my mother. She is a fine artist. I used to think I rebelled and became a scientist, but I guess I realized that art and science really are one and the same. So she had sketched a possum, and then I asked her if she could put it in a spacesuit, which she did, and I cleaned it up and put the logo imagery about it.
It looks like an angry possum.
Oh, we like to say whimsical and a little bit skitterish, but I guess it can be interpreted with a number of different emotions.
It is a cool logo. I can't believe Paul actually sent in a question about it, but it is pretty cool. So Jerry is in San Diego as well. Do you have interns from university in your program? If so, how do you apply?
Well, we always look for people to get engaged, and we have a pretty good track record of finding niches for volunteers. There's other aspects and projects, outreach that we're looking at doing. I invite anyone that has an interest to contact me on the website, projectpossum.org. And the project itself is a mix of a number of universities. It doesn't really belong to any one particular university. It's being managed through Integrated Spaceflight Services, and the data products come through GATS Incorporated. And I would just invite anyone to contact. There's there's a broader application of the project. Noctilucent clouds are the first application of this, but what we really are looking at doing is validating a way to deploy spacecraft for things of scientific interest globally. So by being able to actually take a LINX and put it in a C-130 Hercules or a 747 cargo, we'll be able to take it anywhere where there's a suitable runway, which needs to be 7,500 feet, and has the correct permits to allow operations from that. But the ultimate vision of this really is to be able to provide universities or institutions with a space program in a box. We can take an experiment manifest or payloads and being able to put them together in a deployment, a week long or a 2 week deployment, and bring this anywhere in the world. Oh, and by the way, we'll be able to fully train operators and scientist astronauts. We'll have validated instruments that we'll be using for the Possum experiment, but that can be applied in many other ways, such as the Possum Observatory and the Agronomy Laboratory, or we can design or develop or test or integrate any payload that you want to integrate as well. And we provide the training and the services, and we provide we engage educators so that they can work with students to be able to provide secondary payloads as part of dedicated missions. So vision really is to be able to take most of the countries in the world that have yet to be represented in manned spaceflight and say, well, we can represent a scientific deployment, or we may be able to even bring the whole show to you, to your university or to your country, and be able to train your scientists, train your educators, use our payloads, or we'll develop your payloads, and we can plan a whole deployed campaign. So that's a broader vision. So certainly there's lots of ways to get engaged. It depends on your interest. We are very much looking for support through foundations for the science or investor partners as well. But that said, there's lots of opportunities to really learn from some amazing individuals that have been a part of this and to get engaged hands-on and get engaged with any of these aspects. So please feel free to get in contact with any of us that are on our website.
Christine sent in an email from Salt Lake City, and I don't know what's with the phones, but anyway, Christine says, you mentioned the northern latitudes, so does the same thing exist in the extreme southern latitudes?
Indeed, Christine, it does. And it and on both sides of the poles, it occurs at around the summer solstice to about a month after. So at the far northern latitudes, and realistically, we're talking about 55 degrees and north, we can see these. So if any of the listeners live at these latitudes, especially around Edmonton or any of the Scandic capital cities, very good opportunity to see these from mid-June through mid-August.
Okay, and if you're in the southern hemisphere, it would be the same thing, but it would be our winter up here, right?
Indeed. If you happen to live in Ushuaia, for example, great latitude to see these, and you'll be seeing them in January.
So San Francisco's not far enough north. We're, what, about 45 degrees north or something like that?
I don't think there's ever been an observation from San Francisco. However, we've seen these come to latitudes as far south as Boulder, Colorado, which is 40 degrees. these have been recent developments, too. So that supports more that we're seeing these to lower and lower latitudes. So they're increasing in intensity and presence.
So you could be active during our summer and then head to the southern hemisphere. You could be active all year round.
Indeed, but there's logistical and operations constraints around Antarctica to do a flight campaign or a suborbital campaign. Now, there's been a number of remote sensing platforms, LIDAR systems, different platforms that have looked at these in Antarctica, but it's just logistically a lot more difficult to do.
Harry is in Phoenix, Arizona, and he says, you haven't really talked much about the vehicles other than the capability they offer you for your research, but do you have any concerns about vehicle safety or aborting, given that when David introduced you, he said you had worked with aborts and egress and Constellation and some heavy-duty rocket plans to get astronauts out of them in an emergency. How do you feel about that with something like the Lynx?
Well, the Lynx is a very different bird. Constellation, we had a loss of crew that was acceptable of 1 in 100. There was a launch abort system that gave you a 90% chance of surviving if you liked a 3-second exposure to 20 Gs. Going to a velocity of 17,000 miles an hour and coming and reentering from that speed, very different than what the Lynx will do. Lynx is a suborbital rocket plane, so it's never intended to actually go into orbit. You take off like an aircraft. You pitch up, you have a 3-minute burn with a set of two pairs of coupled engines. And at about 3 minutes, you have your main engine cut off. There you're going at about Mach 3, and you're right about the stratopause, about 48 kilometers high. Well, from there, you're just ballistic. You're free to adjust your attitude, but you never build up that kind of really dangerous heat. That has been a problem, you're always in a pressure suit, so there's a lot of risk mitigation that's just intrinsic to the vehicle itself, and it's a winged vehicle, so you always have plenty of room to glide. There's not a risk. There's much less risk of having an off-field landing because you go straight up and you have a much greater area to be able to control the vehicle once you come to a sufficient altitude. So I would just say the Lynx and Virgin and a number of these vehicles are just intrinsically a lot more safe by design.
But you can't get out of a Lynx. There's no abort or anything, right?
I don't think X-Core has finalized abort plans. I know that we're looking into standard parachute-style egress, but I don't know if they... I think that was based on a conversation from about a year ago. I don't know if that's still a part of the baseline or not. So that is... I'm not positive what their any kind of abort plans are. I assume it might be that it's just like many general aviation aircraft. It's probably assumed to be safer in the vehicle and just glide to landing. You know, the Lynx can land much like a general aviation aircraft. It can land about the same speed, not much of a different speed than the Mooney, a little bit faster, but still, it's very controllable and very manageable.
Were you a fan of Constellation? I know it was your work, so you probably had to like it. But did you think it was a good program?
Yes and no. Constellation, I would first say I worked with some of the most brilliant people in my life. The Constellation, it was an amazing experience. I think it, in the first 3 or 4 years, was a lot more exciting than the last couple. You know, it was never fully funded properly for what we set out to do. at the same time what we were doing, we kept cutting more and more out of the baseline. There was so much that was constrained by the capabilities of the launch vehicle itself and how much mass we could do, carry up. And so we kept, mass was constantly an issue in Orion, for one. There were constraints for operability. You know, going to the space station had the most unfortunate ascent profile of putting you over the North Atlantic. So there was a lot of concern with what happens with ascent aborts. You know, it's always a more expensive way to do things when you go through a very big government-funded project like that. And you look at how SpaceX is approaching this, and, you know, hats off to Elon Musk. He's revolutionizing quite a lot in that way. One of the things being involved with rescue and recovery that still is a concern to me is that, you know, we're developing these new systems, these commercial systems, you know, Sierra Nevada and SpaceX, but we've yet to really investigate commercially what's going to happen when something goes wrong. You know, we've designed these vehicles to get people away, but the infrastructure that we've always had intact for government-controlled space programs, we've have DOD support, or we have AMVAIR, which is the Coast Guard network of ships available, or international SAR agreements, or agreements between countries, or even agreements between space-faring countries for on-orbit contingencies. That's all been in place for government programs, but now you have commercial vehicles with international crews, potentially, and if you have an asset on board, you know, who's gonna come get you? And it's presumed that the same infrastructure that will get a pilot in distress will get astronauts in distress. But with some of these space programs, you have a much higher probability of being in distress in some parts of the world. Unlike aviation, where you just have a general distribution of potential problems, you know, your ascent ground track is by two orders of magnitude a much greater chance that you're going to end up there. So there's a lot of uncertainties. Do we require insurance to do this? You know, you want to do something crazy like ski across Greenland. Well, the government in Denmark won't let you do that unless you buy insurance. And you buy insurance, and then they assume the probability. And if you get in trouble, well, you've already prepaid for it. And maybe something like that will apply to space.
What about climbing Everest? Do you have to buy insurance for that?
I don't know. I'm not sure of the Nepalese or Chinese.
Well, from what I hear in talking to the people, first of all, most of the new space companies don't even think about what you're talking about. I mean, their attitude is there's going to be accidents, people are going to die, and just like in the early days of aviation, you know, the industry will eventually get safer, and we just have to accept the risk factor. But I've never had a discussion on the space show of who's going to come rescue anybody. I don't think I've ever, in the 12-plus years I've been doing this show, ever had a company talk about – they talk about accident control, but mainly from a publicity perspective, like, you know, get over it, there are going to be accidents, on and on, something of that nature. But in terms of what is the infrastructure in place to do a rescue if you go down someplace and there are actually survivors, I don't think anybody's ever mentioned it or talked about it.
There's a number of things that make this you know, an interesting time. You know, rescue recovery, Constellation, was not one of the more glorious things to do in a program, but for me was so interesting because everything came down to it. Rescue and recovery trades had involved, you know, to properly figure out how you're going to create an architecture that, one, is multinational and then has different layers of support. From anything from, you know, ships of opportunity to dedicated resources and everything, but you have to plan in what are your failures with your rocket, what are your failures for your spacecraft, what on-orbit failures from medical standpoints or mechanical standpoints. You have to tie not just a season, but you have to do, you know, distributions of where you could end up and how much money or safety margin or operability constraints that you want to throw at the problem to try to make it better or not. And so it's, I found it to be one of the more interesting, convoluted problems of developing space architecture. Because no matter what happens, if you, everything comes down to a rescue operation, you know, unless you don't survive the abort. I mean, it's just a recovery operation. But if you have any kind of off-nominal plan, it comes down to your rescue operation.
Well, I'm going to start asking that question when I have these guys on the show. I'll bet you they haven't thought of it, or they don't think it's a high enough likelihood that they have to deal with it.
You know, it's not just people coming, but it's what all can go wrong once you land, and how do you want to protect people once you land? Because every bit you throw at protecting people is weight or money or some cost you pay for it.
Well, of course, the suborbitals are going to land, you know, basically where they took off from, but maybe eventually that will change. I don't know. I honestly don't think they think much about rescue recovery, or if they do, they clearly don't want to talk much about it because maybe they don't have a rescue recovery plan. It's really interesting. As I said, I'm going to throw that into my line of questioning the next time these people come on the show or advocates start talking about it. I'm going to ask them what those plans are.
Well, for suborbital flight, it's not as much of an issue. You know, for the links, unless you have some terminal engine problem right at the point where you're pitching up from takeoff, pretty much anything that would cause an engine shutout, you're going to have sufficient altitude just to turn around and glide back and land.
Yeah, if you don't have structural problems from it. But, yeah, you can probably glide back. And the Lynx has an advantage because it can pretty much land like a general aviation plane.
Right. And Virgin as well. You're already at altitude, so it's probably even has... Yeah, that's one of the safer designs most likely out there.
I wonder if they have a decent glide path. Do you have any? Do you know any much about that?
I'm not sure, but I can't imagine Virgin releasing the vehicle anywhere that's outside of a safe glide back to the spaceport.
Well, it'll be fun to see all of this start operating and see it really taking place. And I think it's going to be really exciting. And then when projects such as yours start flying. And this opens up a whole new kind of research. I wish they had those old movie tone newsreels for 5 minutes, you know, before the movie started, where they showed the X-15 and different research high altitude balloon projects and things going on in the 50s and the 60s. I mean, this would be perfect to really motivate people and let them see what was going on with the suborbitals and projects such as yours and others. If they did resurrect something like the old movie tone news clips before a movie started, you're probably too young to remember any of that. But this just made to order for that kind of programming, and they were really inspiring. I mean, we saw the X-15. I mean, you know, on their flights and things like that all the time. And there's really cool stuff, those old black and white movie tone things. Your project would be perfect for that before movies started, for education of the mass population. And maybe someone will resurrect something like that when these vehicles start flying.
Hey, well, we hope this is going to get, you know, it'd be able to really educate people about how to understand our atmosphere, you know, kind of show the same things in a very accessible way with noctilucent clouds, for example, as Jim Balog did with Chasing Ice. I think it's a great example of something that can really engage the general public. And I think we've got a good story to tell here, too. You know, there's a novel platform, and it's, we hope would be something that's exciting and engaging, and also will be very will be very educating to the public about another key element of understanding this extremely complex and large issue of global climate.
Connie in Houston sent in a note, and it said, it seems to me that most of what you're talking about, your flights take place over land, but what about the northern or even the southern oceans? Do these clouds form over the ocean, or are they always over a landmass?
They are generally over equally distributed over the polar areas. I don't think there's that much of a signature, you know, depending if it's land or if it's over ocean. You know, we've looked at some of the features in the clouds that could be triggered by orographics, like a mountain range that might excite a wave, a gravity wave, as we call it, that would propagate upwards and cause a band structure in the cloud. But we haven't really noticed any direct relationship to the clouds, whether they form over land or over water. They're mostly up here at that time of the year and down to a certain latitude.
Are you able to conclude that CO2 going into the atmosphere is a bad thing? Like the climate change people say, you know, man is, you know, doing this and this damage to the atmosphere, to the Earth, and all that. Do these clouds in your research confirm that, or is it something totally different?
I would say that's not necessarily a fair way to look at it. We look at these really as a harbinger of climate change. We want to see if the overall trend of observation is related ultimately to changes of concentrations of the lower atmosphere. So it's more, I guess, it's more a way of observing what's happening in the upper atmosphere and having confidence in what we're observing reflects other changes in the atmosphere as a whole.
Really fascinating research that you're doing. Do you think that, I mean, a lot of people that I talk to obviously want to fly on the Lynx and Virgin as a space tourist, right? They just want to go for their joyride. Can you do a research mission like you're talking about and still have it be a space tourist joyride, or does the amount of focus and concentration and working of instruments and all that really keep you busy as a scientific researcher?
Well, that's a good question. You know, certainly, this is one of the things that we see as a very positive thing for the industry as a whole is really showing what this can do for science. Indeed, the bane of the industry tends to be this perception that commercial suborbital space is joyrides for billionaires.
Right.
That said, the program that we are establishing and that we're going to be making public towards the end of this year, it's actually based around possum sorties and the instruments, campaigns like this. And we're going to be basing the training that we are focusing on our own operators and trying to engage people that are interested in eventually flying these themselves and providing the same kind of training. So it's there are a number of different ways we can create very affordably the same stresses and environments that one would experience on these flights, through both exposure to reduce gravity and high G, being able to work control of the vehicle, the crew resource management, understanding how to use spacesuits and how to address off-nominal situations in the spacesuits as well. And it's simple, simply working in such a confined environment and then knowing exactly what structures in the clouds in real time are where to go and get. So I want to say it's something that you would want to throw a high-paying customer that that just wants to do something, but something that we can train people to be able to do.
Your website also talks about you'll fly other people's experiments, right?
Yes, we're always looking at expanding this campaign by developing deployments, not only the high-latitude deployment. Mojave is a mid-latitude, and we also are looking at an equatorial deployment. We're looking at building dedicated campaigns in these regions. So we're always looking for experiments, people that have an idea, finding ways to continually integrate this into campaigns, into ways where payloads can complement each other into addressing very specific scientific questions. So we are building two groups. Within POSSUM, we have instrument teams that are mostly engineers developing instrumentation. And amongst the instrumentation is the POSSUM Observatory, which we're using to image the clouds, but it's also an Earth observing suite of all sorts of images. We have visible, we have infrared, and we have oxygen A-band spectrometer that can look at spatially resolved temperatures, all in a remotely controlled way that can target specific locations on the Earth automatically or manually. So we're developing this kind of instrumentation, but also we have we call the POSSUM Science Applications Team, and they're scientists that specialize in certain applications that can be not just aeronomy, like these clouds are in. They could be in atmospheric sciences. They could be in oceanography or glaciology or hydrology or forestry or all sorts of different things. And the idea here, and we're having a town hall at the American Geophysical Union, is to bring these together and see how people's experiments can support other people's science and how other people's science ideas can engage other people's payloads and how we can put these together in specific locations to be able to make everyone happy and have a deployment that satisfies a wide range of instrument applications and science applications. So that's I definitely would encourage anyone. You could go to our website and please send an email if you have an interest in this or a scientist and have a specialization in an area that you'd like to represent the team in, or have an idea of a payload or want to get involved with finding applications for your own instrumentation.
You have one additional question, and it may be the last question of the evening, since we're coming up on the bottom of the hour. This is from Carl, and Carl's in Reno, Nevada, and he says, "I'm a little bit confused. If I want to fly a mission, is this just contact you, make arrangements to fly it, pay the cost of it, and your people will fly the mission and do the science that I want done? Or does the project have to be reviewed and accepted? Or does it have to conform to the kinds of projects you're doing?"
Okay, fair enough. Well, X-Core or any vehicle provider needs to get paid for the vehicle for the flights. So it's always always finding ways to best fund these. We can provide opportunities for flights, or we can. There's number of payload spaces, anything supporting small CubeSat size payloads to uses of imagers. There's different payloads, and we can work to integrate the payload. We can work with you to try to find public funds, or work with you to try to find foundation support for research that is of solid benefit. If there is a primary payload, if there's a major human-tended instrument that you would propose, we can work with you for funding, or if you have funding and want to fly that, we can use we can work with that to bring it together. You can use one of our flight operators on the experiment, or we can train yours. So there's a lot of ways we could go about it. It's hard to say. We've got to kind of go case by case.
So case by case, people should contact you. And again, what do they do? They contact at info@possumproject.org?
On the website, there's a few different links. There's payloads at projectpossum.org, observatory at projectpossum.org, info, projectpossum.org. My own direct email is jason at integratedspaceflight.com. And we'll be able to address your question or get you in touch with someone that hopefully can.
Terrific. And in terms of takeaways or closing comments, what would you like listeners to take away tonight or remember, or what would be your closing comments for them to remember or hold on to?
Oh, wow. I think this has been such a broad conversation. It's hard to know where to get going. I appreciate I appreciate your time and having me on your show and all the questions. And it's been great hearing what ideas people have out there. I guess the takeaway is, please think about ways we can work together and be able to best use these capabilities to understand our world better. And so it's hard to really address with so many different kinds of people that have been involved and expressed interest in this. But certainly we do our best to bring it all together and to create a program that we trust will be a great global benefit.
Listeners, Jason hasn't mentioned it, but on their homepage for projectpossum.org, you can sign up for a newsletter and information. So if you want to follow what they're doing and stay informed, if you think you may have an interest or a project down the road or something like that, it's a good way to keep informed with what they're doing. So I signed up tonight. I would urge each of you to sign up as well. And again, it's on their homepage, projectpossum.org. Jason, we'll continue to follow you. Now, I'll look forward to talking to you when you become operational with the Lynx or whichever vehicle it is. I'd like to talk to you after you do some of the flights and experiments. I think it'd be really interesting to see how things are turning out, what you're learning, what some of the reality is of flying versus some of what we're talking about in the planning stages.
Great. Thank you, David. We have a Facebook page as well. So jump on just Project Possum. And like us and can follow our progress there.
Are you on LinkedIn as well?
Not the project, no.
Okay.
I am personally.
Okay. So Facebook and sign up on their website, listeners. And that will be it for our program tonight. And remember, we're doing a special program in the morning with Brian Wheaton on the Space Fence. He's with Secure World, and that will be 9:30 a.m. California time. And you don't want to miss that show. And Jason, thanks a lot for being with us and introducing us to Project Possum. And we'll continue to stay on top of it. And I look forward to talking to you again down the road. Thank you for being with us tonight.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you. Listeners, that's it. Thank you for emailing in your questions and comments for us. And look forward to hearing from you again tomorrow morning with Brian. Good night from the Space Show.